This episode is brought to you by Diageo Bar Academy. Learn more at DiageoBarAcademy.com. That's D-I-A-G-E-O BarAcademy.com.
This week's episode of Meat in 3 is inspired by the reemergence of Cicada Brood 10. We're talking all about insects.
Some people are calling crickets the gateway bug because that's a great introduction to what edible insects is all about.
So we found detectable levels of cesium-137 in 68 of 122 total honey samples that we had.
What is that?
Is it tarantula?
No, what is it?
It's a tarantula.
Oh, and they're going to eat it? No.
Listen to Meat in 3 wherever you get your podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some in the air.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Greg, how are you, my friend?
I'm sweaty. How are you doing, man?
Yeah, it's a hot one. Brooklyn, baby. summer is upon us in a flash, right? The gears shift so hard between seasons in this town.
I kind of love it, though, man. I mean, like, I love New York summer. I love that kind of, like, you know, I love escaping down to the beach, you know, once every couple of, you know, months. I love how, like, at the end of summer in September, everyone's, like, always trying to cram in their beach days that they thought they were going to get. Mm-hmm. I love the heat. I love the, you know, the ice cream trucks everywhere. I don't know, man. I'm just a sucker for New York City summer. It makes me happy. It's like that and Christmas are the two things that just, like, I enjoy despite all the cheesiness, despite some of the uncomfortable elements to it. I just think they're fun, you know?
Yeah, I'm digging it too. You know, my new apartment has a backyard, so I'm getting to spend a bunch of time out there. I get up in the mornings, and that's where I go sort of catch up on social media, emails, etc. And then my new apartment also has, a subterranean floor. I have half of my apartment's above the ground and half of it's below. And down here where I'm at right now in the studio, it's quite cool and nice. But speaking
Austin,
of
you've got a little cave that you can escape to.
Yeah, kinda, right? It's definitely it's got windows, you know, like Laverne and Shirley style, like garden windows. you know, that are up above, like at the high part of the wall. But it's nice and cool down here, like noticeably, like a solid 20-degree difference between upstairs and downstairs at any given time. But speaking of sneaking away to the beach, Damon's not here with us today because he and Dylan, his twin brother, are celebrating what they call Twinsmas, which is their birthday, which was yesterday, in Hawaii.
Creepy.
Yeah. It is kind of creepy. I don't not look forward to the photos, but I don't really look forward to the photos.
And it's not just the fact that they have the same face, it's that they have the exact same aesthetic. Like, you kind of have to look at the tattoos to tell which one is which.
Oh, 100%.
And that's the weird part.
100%. They have the same hair, the same beard, obviously the same face, same build. They dress the same. And I think that the most interesting part about that to me, and I've certainly probably talked about it at too much length on the show with Damon, is that it all kind of happened separately. They currently live in the same city, but for, nearly a decade, they didn't. And, you know, if you look back on the Speakeasy's Instagram page, you can see that photo of 10 years of Damon, where he was a clean cut, you know, handsome fellow before he became a long haired hippie fellow.
From Buddy Holly to Willie Nelson in a flash.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but that's crazy is that Dylan did the same sort of transformation on the other side of the country. So, you know, they're both wearing giant turquoise rings and cowboy hats and sporting big long beards and braided hair. You know, it's like, how does that? But that's the mystery of twins. That's the creepiness of twins.
Nature and nurture, man. I mean,
yes, sir.
I don't know. I'm like about as skeptical as they come. But my grandma was a twin for a very, very long time. And like,
and then she wasn't.
Well, I mean, my grandma is 94. I guess she is still a twin. It's just she outlasted her brother.
Oh, that.
But it was super weird how they could like tune into each other's thoughts. Like, I don't really believe in anything that you can't see or prove. Don't mistake that for saying that we know everything. Clearly, we don't. But, you know, it's like I am very skeptical about anybody that claims to have like psychic powers or, you know, astrology or anything like that. And yet there's just so much undeniable evidence that I've seen with my own eyes of her and her brother just kind of knowing what the other one is up to without having to actually communicate in any sort of discernible way. It's very weird. It was very weird and continues to be really weird when I tell the stories. Like, I would hang out in your kitchen and she'd be saying, oh, you know, I think I should call Don. And 5 minutes later, the phone would ring and Don was like, hey, I feel like, you know, you wanted to call. So here I am. Now that's now that's creepy.
Yeah, it is. Ooh, yeah, yeah. And many times when I would be hanging out with Damon and Dylan would show up in nearly an identical get up, you know, like that's where it just starts getting weird.
We'll never know, man. As non-twins, I guess we'll never get it. We'll just have to
Yeah, I got no siblings at all. I don't know about you, but I know that our guest has siblings. So let's bring him into the virtual
yes,
studio.
Yes, absolutely.
How was that for a segue?
A plus, bumpy
at best.
We miss those. We miss you, Damon. We miss those segues. And happy birthday, bud. Glad you're getting some much needed R&R out there.
Happy birthday, Damon. Miss you a ton. Realizing yesterday, by the way, that I haven't seen Damon face to face since February of last year. So it's really nuts, man.
Anyway, yeah. In the studio with us today, we have distiller and vegan meat pioneer and proud brother Louis Catazone of St. Agrestis. Louis, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very, very well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for giving up some of your time today to hang out with us in the virtual studio. Soon, I hope we're going to get back to the real studio. I don't know.
Oh, I can't wait. Right when it's going to be nice and hot, too. That's what I was thinking today. It's like, I can't wait to get back inside of a metal shipping container. That's going to rule.
Ironically, right after this, I have to go to Roberta's anyway, so it would have been perfect if we were there.
my sympathy is that you have to go to Roberta's.
Oh, it's truly my pleasure, but it is business. But I'm excited to go to Roberta's as always.
we all have these crosses to bear, I guess.
Well, and so, that's the thing too. I think you know, we're in the business of pleasure, so you know, surely you're going over there to show your wares and you'll be able to enjoy their wares while you're there. And that's a huge draw to this field of endeavor, I think, for a lot of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And they serve my wares and I'm thankful and grateful for that, but it's hard to go there without leaving overstuffed. And luckily for Amaro, we have a solution to that sensation.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've been doing St. Agrestis right here in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, for how long now?
Since summer of 2017, so really coming up on 4 years now.
Man, pretty amazing. And what made you say to yourself, you know what I need to get into? Making Amaro.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Souther, from past conversations, but my dad is from Italy. Now, he's from down in Calabria. And my mom's actually from Greenpoint, not too far from your previous apartment, Souther. But we... Amaro was kind of in the background of my life. It was during our stereotypical Sunday dinners. It was, which of course in an Italian American household happens at 2 p.m. And after dinner ends up lasting from about 3:30 p.m. through the rest of the night. But we always had Amaro on the table during that after dinner portion of the meal, which was most of the day. And an Amaro called Amaro Solano, which I'm sure you've heard of because you know Amaro, was like kind of in the background of all those childhood memories. But not until I got into the wine and spirits industry and started to see the trend happening did I think that I would ever have any professional dealings with this spirit that, you know, while everyone was stealing vodka from their parents' liquor cabinets, I was stealing Amaro Solano and trying to share it with people, which was not a successful experience for most of them, none of them even. But yeah, that's kind of, you know, I grew up with Amaro, but I didn't necessarily expect to get into it. And then it kind of fell into my lap to some degree.
Wow. I mean, it's just so amazing that Amaro would fall into anyone's lap. And it's such an opportune time, because I think, you know, that's when I think of Amaro is really moving from being a very niche product to being something that at least, you know, people, if they, even if they didn't, you know, run an Amaro themed bar, for example, at least I feel like there was a trend where most folks that you would talk to on the street would at least know what it was, would know that it was this sort of Italian bitter aperitif sort of thing.
I mean, I'm totally on board with that line of thinking, Greg, but I still think it's incorrect. I think that's an insular angle. You know, I think we think that now most people know what Amaro is, but we're thinking that inside of our tiny bubble of who pays attention to the cocktail world. I think still at large, it's an untapped vein, and you know, which I think, you know, means there's plenty of opportunity for growth.
That's definitely true. And my experience traveling across the country, kind of pouring Amaro for folks in different cities, I've probably done, I don't know, 1,500 hours of in-store tastings where I post up in a liquor store and whoever walks in, unconditioned, no idea what they're expecting, gets to have me offer them a pour of St. Agrestis Amaro. And even 4 years ago in Brooklyn, a lot less people knew what St. Agrestis was. Nowadays, it's a lot higher of a proportion, and it's because I've been pouring, it's because you've been pouring. Folks get these experiences with Amaro, but I've poured plenty of people, and totally unsuspecting, when they walked into the liquor store, their first serving of Amaro, which has come with some grimaces, as I'm sure you've seen in your day too. The main difference being that when someone walked into Amore Amargo, for example, they would know that they were getting into Amaro more likely than not. I guess that's not a 100%, but it certainly was the general majority of people would be expecting Amaro versus the person who came in for a bottle of Tito's and ended up getting served some bitter aperitivo.
Right. Yeah, sure. There's you know, the expectation of the place you're walking into. But when you're walking into any old liquor store, which generally has a broad spread of items on offer, you may, yeah, as you said, be going in there just to pick up a bottle of, I don't know, Malibu coconut rum. And then you got this guy trying to shove this dark, brooding, bittersweet thing down your throat. What would you say the reaction is to, well, first of all, I would say, what percentage of people said, no, thank you, right, just off the bat, not going to do it, when you told them what it was? And then of the people who were hesitant but did it anyway, what was the reaction, positive or negative?
So I guess my results in this were kind of skewed for a few reasons. Number one would be going back to that bubble that you spoke of. We do generally live in a really, really cool area where even people who might not be as involved in the industry as we are still informed and curious, which is
that's the why key. Curiosity.
For sure. And weird products like Amaro can become popular and mainstay items on someone's bar cart thanks to the curiosity of people in general. But here in Brooklyn, people like to try things. And that goes for Manhattan as well, of course. Neighborhood specific to some degree, I'd say, but that can be said about Brooklyn too. But the other thing that I had working to my advantage is that I make the Amaro. So when I'd say, hey, I make this Amaro in Greenpoint, and people would say, oh, you make it, there's usually a little bit more of a curiosity again to try it because they're actually standing in front of the person who produced it.
Like they feel a little less emboldened to just say no to you because you made the thing.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It's easier to say no to the kid who's just like, try this tomorrow.
Yeah, 100%. So
I work for these guys.
Yeah. I have had many situations where they're like, well, if I don't like it before I taste it, you're not going to be offended, are you? And I said, no, of course not. I just want you to try it. That way, you know, maybe your third or fourth experience with Amaro this is going to just help you get to a place where you can actually stomach it and if you find it palatable, because I think it does take a couple of tries with something as unique and also, you know, herbal as Amaro. It's just not familiar for us as Americans, but most folks.
Or as a species, though. That's the thing I try and impress upon people all the time when they're coming in, you know, fresh to Amore Amargo, you know, that we only taste the five things: sweet, sour, salty, umami, and bitter. And only one of those five is an acquired taste, and that's bitter. You have to taste it several times before you're adjusted to it. You know, the joke that I commonly use is, if kids ran the world, we wouldn't have broccoli. Too bitter for them, right? But over time, you try the broccoli and you're like, ew, gross, get this away. And then as you grow up and mature, you try it again and you try it again. And you're like, oh, you know what? I do like this. So I feel like you're an extra hard row to hoe if you're out there just handing people something they, A, didn't expect to get anything, right? They just went to the store. They didn't know they were going to get a sample of something, much less in tomorrow. But so A, you're handing them anything. And B, you're handing them something that's kind of got a built-in system that says you're not going to buy it on this one try. You're going to have to come try it a few times.
Well, see, I actually kind of have to push back on you a little bit like that. Because I did a little reading on the science of bitterness for an episode of Back Bar. It's actually going to be coming out next week on the 15th.
Nice plug.
I know, right? and, you know, it's interesting because, like you said, it's the only taste that is biologically programmed in our brains to make it to tell us not to eat something. You know, every other taste that you just mentioned, like, you know, salt tells us about the presence of electrolytes, sour can clue us into vitamins, umami tells us about protein, sweet tells us about sugar, bitter tells us that what we're eating might be poisonous.
Right.
But there is research to suggest that that might not actually be true, and our bodies actually have bitter receptors kind of all over in weird places that you wouldn't think that bitter receptors would be. They're on our skin, they're in our lungs. Hilariously, they're even in our testicles. And it sort of makes you realize that, like, bitterness is this sense that we don't understand. And when I think about, you know, drinking black coffee or drinking a shot of Underberg, I don't think of it as a unpleasant experience. I think about it as something that makes me sort of sit up and, like, pause and take a moment and go back. And the science isn't so much that it's a knee-jerk reaction, ew, I don't like this, at least as adults. It's a reaction of, what the hell is that? This bears more investigation.
Yeah.
I want more and I want to try it more.
Yeah, I can totally see and understand that. I think there's something to be said in there somewhere, though, about experience, which I think would lead back to what I was saying, sort of the acquiring of that taste.
That's true. But again,
we experience bitter as a youth, and we are immediately sort of turned off by it. And I think that's at the biological programming of, this could be dangerous to myself as a one person, but also could be dangerous to the species as a whole. But then, literally just by living, whether you ever touch another bitter thing at all, you gain more experience of how things react to your personal body. So you might be more interested in trying something again, you know?
Yeah. And I think that that's interesting to use that word, sort of experience, because it's the only flavor, it's the flavor that I can think of the most that, like, you know, it hits something in the front human part of my brain, and I have to actually experience that flavor more so than, you know, think of ice cream, which I also enjoy. But I mean, Louis, you know, you have field data that you can shed a light on here in this discussion. Like, when you were passing out these samples to people, what were their reactions? What did they say? What kind of feedback did you get from, you know, the man or the woman on the street?
Well, first of all, I just kind of want to take a step back and acknowledge that there are bitter receptors on testicles. That's
yes.
In and of
yes.
itself.
In the heart, too. There's some in the heart as well. You can have a bitter heart.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, I kind of have to almost think more like Souther, as far as, if there's bitter receptors on your testicles, then yeah, you're taught to, like, kind of avoid them, right? That's my association, at least. But I'll move on to your question. Yeah, I think that in a lot of cases, there's been instances where, if it was someone's first experience with a Marum, they definitely didn't buy it. But if someone had just gone to a Moria Margo or had a meal at a restaurant that had an Amaro program and was served some Amaro after a meal, whether it be an Amaro made here in the US or a big brand Amaro produced in the motherland or in Europe in general, that person was way more likely to enjoy their experience with St. Agrestis Amaro. Now, I think that would make sense with any spirit. It's not specific to Amaro. If someone had Jamaican rum for the first time, they'd say, why is this so funky? What is that smell? What's the deal with this? But when you have it the second time, you're expecting it, and you kind of, you know, your taste buds to some degree are a little bit prepared for it, assuming that your memory doesn't suck, which, you know, for some of us, our memories do suck. I think that experience and memory is really what makes the actual enjoyment, and in a lot of cases, the associations with any spirit, whether it's Amaro or tequila, enjoyable.
That is interesting.
That's kind of my train of thought as well. And everything that I've kind of come to believe in my experience with this stuff, it sort of points that way. I want to ask, though, well, I also want to remind the listener, you know, Amaro, and this is the problem with translation, right? The word itself translates to mean bitter. But the thing, the liquid that we're talking about, translates to mean bittersweet liqueur, right? And I think it's really important that we say the sweet part, because Amaro, the only difference really between an Amaro and a tincture bitter is some kind of sweetener to make it more potable, more drinkable, you know, giving it balance. Difficult to have a glass of Peixoto's bitters before lunch, but very easy to have a glass of Campari before lunch, right? Because of that the balance of making it potable by having a sweetener added. So I don't like to scare people off by saying, this is bitter, it's just bitter, the word means bitter, which I think, sadly, is how the public shares that information with one another. And I think the ones who are enthusiasts inadvertently scare off the ones who might have been. You know, I talk all the time about how maybe two people will come in, and one's like an Amaro nerd, and he's read about the bar for years, and he's so excited to be there with his friend, and he looks up and sees something like Novosalis, and he's like, oh my God, give us two Novosalis. And I'm like, your friend here has never had Amaro. Why give him that? He's never going to have it again. You know, so I'll give you this, but I want to talk to your friend and coach him in a little bit, you know? So I think it's important to mention, or to remind anyway, that sweetness is part of the program when we talk about Amaro. And then I want to talk about just specifically your Amaro, St. Agrestis. You want to talk to us about the flavor profile? I have my own words about it, but I don't want to taint yours.
Sure. Well, and I think sweetness, in addition to obviously flavors that aren't just bitter.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And that's what makes the possibility of an Amori Amargo real, because you can go there and experience hundreds of visits and you can continue to pull out a different bottle for that same person who's been to your bar hundreds of times. And the experience will be unique every single time, because Amaro has such a wide spectrum of bitter and sweet, but also of just different flavor profiles based off of the herbs, spices, flowers, roots, seeds, citrus that go into it. Now, St. Agrestis is quite unique in that it's pretty spice driven in and of itself. And that's probably the first and most easily recognizable things. And I think you can make an Amaro approachable in two different ways. One way being by making it sweeter, and another by making it familiar. And with St. Agrestis Amaro, we opted for complex and nuanced, but familiar and balanced in bitter and sweet. That was the goal. So St. Agrestis Amaro has cinnamon, clove, and allspice first. That kind of gets balanced out with a high tone green note of the spearmint and peppermint that gives that cooling sensation. And then the finish, you get that sarsaparilla root, which is quintessentially American. And I always call it the snapping botanical, because when I'm pouring it for somebody and they recognize that flavor, yes, because it's so nostalgic, but they can't figure out exactly where they recognize it from, because perhaps it's been 20, 40, 60 years since the person I'm pouring it for had a root beer, but they know that they remember this flavor, and it's usually kind of transportive, which is super fun as well.
Yeah, I am a big fan of your juice. It's it definitely has that sarsaparilla vibe. I like to, as with many Amaro, I like to just drink it long with some seltzer, and it does kind of mimic somewhat like a minted, you know, root beer situation.
Totally.
So it makes it pretty easy to grab off the shelf and take on its own, or it's got lots of possibilities in the cocktail world. Let's take a break real quick and hear from our sponsors. We're going to come back and keep talking about locally made St. Agrestis Amaro with Louis. So stand by.
Souther, it's hot. It's hot in Brooklyn.
Man,
finally.
It's crazy hot. I love it, as you know. I think I always talk about how, you know, for me, surface of the sun is the temperature I want it to be all the time.
Me too, man. I'm a lizard. I love just like basking out in this heat. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I love seeing
and
it.
I know, and people are out drinking cocktails again, which is fantastic.
Yeah,
cocktails
man.
To go are still here. Thank goodness, like people are out on the street. Like, you know, I can walk to my favorite spot and grab a frozen drink to go. It's quite nice. New York's back, baby.
Yeah, man, turn up the heat, turn up the thirst. I think people are out there really going for it. Two reasons, one, it is hot, and two, I think also, you know, they didn't get to do this last year. So I'm noticing here and there, I know you're not kind of in it right now, but I am. I'm noticing here and there that people are maybe going a little too far from time to time, more often than they would normally. I think it's the newness of it being back. So I think it's important that we take care and monitor them in a more caring way, be a little bit more responsible about the way we serve.
And you know, we've joked about this, about how low and no ABV cocktails are always like, oh, like this is going to be their year. But you know, I think especially, you know, this year, if you're going to go out and you want to drink six cocktails, why not have six low ABV cocktails? If you want to just like have like, you know, a day where you just go out and you ride a nice buzz and you can still be responsible, or you can still get up for work the next day or what have you, like no and low ABV cocktails are a viable alternative. They're out there. They're good now. They don't suck anymore.
That's right. They're sessionable. And there's plenty of resources out there to get some information on how to go about creating those cocktails. From like Diageo Bar Academy.
Yeah, exactly. DiageoBarAcademy.com, man. Lots of really great resources there, not only about making low and no ABV serves, but also just kind of like, you know, responsible bartending and mindful drinking and watching out for your health, which I really appreciate. You know, we talk about that a lot on the show, but there's a reason for that. They're important topics.
Well, right. We have to be mindful of the fact that we are, you know, altering people's state when we hand them a drink. And then if we hand them another one and another one and another one, we're getting them out there. And maybe we have to be a little bit more mindful of their judgment, you know. So to be able to offer things that are lower ABV, like you said, a little bit sessionable, I think people are smart enough to choose, you know, sessionable beers. But I don't think that people calculate ABV in their minds when they're looking at a menu. This sounds good. I'm going to have it. Maybe that one's a little too stiff. Maybe I should go with this one next. So I think it's part of the program that we should drive people towards the drink that's right for them at the right time. And again, plenty of resources available at Diageo Academy, which is, you know, we've been talking about it for a few weeks. It's such a great thing to have. And the fact that it's free lowers the entry barrier to next to nothing. If you've got access to the internet, you've got this thing. And it's a wide resource that has tons of things on it that you can look into. We've been talking about batched and batching cocktails and cocktails for delivery. We've been talking about, you know, just a canon of recipes from classics to unique ones and seasonal ones. We've been talking about you know, the fact that they have a sort of masterclass situation happening on there with different professionals from all over the world swooping in to talk about particular topics. And again, that it's all free. It's just incredible.
Absolutely, man. There's so much to do there. And, you know, as we keep harping on, it costs you nothing. There's no reason not to check it out. So check out DiageoBarAcademy.com for tons of great resources. That's D-I-A-G-E-O BarAcademy.com. Stay informed, inspired, and connected to grow your career and just learn some fun stuff. Check it out. And we are back. You are listening to The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking with Louis Catazone of St. Agrestis. We're having a very bitter conversation here about the Amaro that he makes. And we got through sort of the genesis of the idea. We talked a little bit about the flavor profile. Now I want to talk about this box with the plastic bladder of pre-batched cocktail that I'm seeing in every liquor store all of a sudden. How's that working out? And how does that loop into sort of a larger RTD program that you're kind of branching out into with your Amaro?
So the ready-to-drink cocktail world was not what I expected I was diving into when we launched the Negroni in the single-serve bottles in a custom single-serve bottle back in 2018, May of 2018. It's, to the day, 3 years and 1 month old since we got into ready-to-drink Negronis. But we also, I think to what you were mentioning, we also launched a ready-to-drink Negroni, the same exact Negroni, but instead of in a bottle, we launched it in a bag-in-box last summer, basically as a pivot during the pandemic because of how folks were drinking at home. We felt like it was an idea that I had years ago, but it was something that didn't necessarily feel like the timing was ever perfect for. Who needs 20 Negronis in a box? I felt like maybe the industry does, maybe some Negroni enthusiasts do. But then
because of to-go cocktail sales being allowed and my bar having no perishable items, we sell all of our cocktails, to-go cocktails, in a 100 milliliter, a 200 milliliter, a 500 milliliter, and a full liter. And, you know, in the beginning anyway, I think it's gotten a little less difficult because people have sort of wised up. People would come in and say, "What, 10, let's say Negronis, 10 Negronis, what am I going to do with 10 Negronis?" And my answer would be, "Yeah, I went to the grocery store and I only wanted one egg, but they sell them by the dozen. And I can eat them at my leisure. I don't have to eat them all at once." Like, it was really hard for me to kind of convince people, like, you don't have to drink 10 at once. It's shelf stable. Relax. Even better than eggs. It's not going to go bad. Yeah. Did you see that as a hurdle at all when you came in? Because it has 30 in a box, right?
20 Negronis in the box.
20 in a box.
Yeah,
right.
20 Negronis. There's 60 ounces, so it's 23 ounce serves.
Yeah.
Of course, folks weren't sure that they needed it. The price point was a little confusing at first because you're looking at a ready-to-drink cocktail that costs $60. So, but then when folks did the math and said, "Oh wow, but that's $3 a Negroni," that's kind of a game changer when you think of it like that. But we absolutely
right. And these are the same, not to like bash the consumer, though I kind of do a lot lately, especially this past year. These are the same guys who would be like, "Oh, I'm down at the Costco grabbing a thing of 1,000 chicken tenders," and you're like, "Yeah, you don't think you're going to drink 20 Negronis in the next, I don't know, 3 weeks?"
Yeah. And the best part about the bag in box is that it truly, there's no oxygen contact or very minimal oxygen contact.
As you drain it, the bag collapses. No air goes in.
Exactly. So the Negroni in bag-in-box virtually will never expire. I mean, it's 24% alcohol or 48 proof, but it could lose some freshness due to oxidation, slight oxidation in a bag-in-box format over the course of 4 months. But you have 3+ months to drink 20 Negronis. And when I tell people that it'll never go bad, they're like, "So I could drink it over a year?" I'm like, "But why do you need to?"
But you know, that just makes the consumer feel safe, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what
that part I kind of understand. But again, the same thing with like, you're buying 1,000 chicken tenders, you know, you're just going to keep them in your freezer basically forever, you know?
Yep. It's a similar concept. And luckily, based off of our timing, and there was a reason we did it when we did it, folks were just drinking so much at home that it made sense for them to have a Negroni fountain in the refrigerator during the summer of 2020 when things got as weird as they did. And, you know, to some degree still remain that weird, but I don't think the concept of having a Negroni on tap in your fridge is something that we've outgrown even as we get back to hopefully full-fledged normals, you know, immediately.
Yeah. I don't think that's going away. I think it gave us time to train people. It gave us time to make them understand that this is a thing that they could have. And also to prove to them that you don't have to up your normal consumption to do this. I think maybe certainly at first when people were like, "Oh, I can't go to bars, so I'm going to stay at home." And I would see the Instagram photos of people making themselves a drink in, you know, basically a pint glass. And I think that's just a common mistake with the home bartender. Portion control is not very well adhered to. So that 20 Negronis might have been, you know, 8 Negronis for someone in the beginning, but now they've kind of learned, you know, like, "Oh, okay, I understand what I'm doing now." Recommended portion size makes more sense, because I think at first people are like, "Well, any size bag of Doritos is a single serving," right? That little tiny one that comes with your lunch all the way up to that big giant one. That's a single serving to the home consumer, right? You got to portion it out for them. But I think that we've trained people well enough to know that now you can have drinks, especially drinks that are all spirits, like a Negroni, on hand, at the ready, kind of forever, if you want it. So I don't think that's going to go back. Would you Would you change anything if you thought it was going to go back? Would you make it like a 10 Negroni box instead of 20?
Nah, I think I like the idea of big and small. It's either one Negroni in a single serve in a intricate glass bottle, or you got 20 Negronis and you can keep it in your fridge, or if you're going away for the week or visiting somebody for a party, boom, you don't have to worry about if they don't have anything up to your standards. You don't want to walk into the party and be handed a white cloth, or you do perhaps, but if you don't, now you can make sure you have your Negroni on tap and you don't have anything to worry about. All they need is ice and you're good to go. No, I wouldn't change it. It's become volumetrically our most important product, believe it or not, since launching it, just because obviously it's huge in 1.75-liter format, which is the biggest. Actually, 1.8 liters was a recent change, but the largest format that the federal government here in the United States will let something registered as a spirit go into. Because otherwise, I'd think, why not maybe even go a little bit bigger?
Sure. Get the home kit where you can transfer your water cooler.
Yeah. It's a party.
Big carabiners full of Negroni. Just tap
then,
it up. Let's go.
And then hit the beach, man.
Yeah, put it in a camelback and get after it. Why not?
Now, is it pre-diluted, or do you have to stir it with your own ice at home? Is there that one little extra step that the consumer has to do?
We made hundreds of Negronis when we finalized the formula for this, and yeah, it's pre-diluted. You'll want to drink it over ice. Unfortunately, it will separate if you froze it. So if you put it in the freezer, the lower alcohol components will actually freeze, leaving you with almost a slushy-like Negroni, which sounds great, except that the higher alcohol liquid components taste high in alcohol. So it ends up being a much more extreme high ester example, or I guess I should say high octane example of a Negroni. But the
it's like you're jacking it, you know, apple jacking it.
Yeah, exactly.
Freezing off some of the non-alcohol to have a greater alcohol.
Yep. Yeah. And that's a version of increasing alcohol to separate it by freezing, as opposed to separating it by heating. Cause obviously there's a different freezing point and a different boiling point, which is why we, even have alcohol to begin with here, at least on the distilled level. But yeah, the Negroni was a really challenging thing to get the proportions perfect on a small scale. And then to say, okay, but what about when we make a 1,000-liter version of this? Is it going to scale exactly the same way? And that had its fun moments, but also figuring out the right amount of water, doing some displacement, everything's done by weight here, everything. And I think that's the only way to do things on as big of a scale and keep it as consistent as we need to. So we weigh everything, which generally happens in a distillery. It also happens behind a lot of bars. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Souther.
You got it. Go.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the how you're finding the RTD market, because we've had it has exploded. I think it was going to explode before the pandemic, and that
it was on its way, right? White Claw and Truly and all those guys were already out there, and they were going 300% growth year over year for the 2 years prior to the pandemic. I haven't seen any numbers about last year, but I assume it just exploded.
Yeah. And you know, we've had a lot of guests on who have launched some really inventive, really cool, really out there, wild, ready to drink drinks. And the common theme that I've heard from all of them is people come up to them and say, oh man, like this is the pandemic. Like this must be such a great time to like be making cocktails in cans. And the response is kind of, because people want to drink at home. Well, they didn't want to, but they had to drink at home for an entire year. But you know, in hard times, it's been my experience, people reach for familiar creature comforts, and they might not necessarily be wanting to try something with, you know, elderflower and sarsaparilla when there's a canned margarita right next to that in the store, and they're like, margarita, I know what that is. So I guess my question is sort of, how has that treated you, and how's that been for you as a Negroni maker? My real question, I guess, being do people outside of the bubble that I apparently live in know Negronis enough that it's had this sort of crossover into the mainstream success, or do you still kind of have to educate people that, like, it's a nuanced drink, it's a bitter drink, it's a botanical drink, but it's probably the best drink that we've ever invented as a species, so you're not going to regret trying it?
Well, I'll start by agreeing with that sentiment. I think it is the greatest cocktail that we've ever created, and I've made plenty of cocktails that aren't Negronis in my life, so I'm it's not as though I'm that biased. I also make a ready-to-drink aperitivo spritz cocktail, so I have two babies in the RTD world. To answer the question, though, or one of the few questions that you threw my way, Greg, I think that there, in the beginning, the very, very beginning of the pandemic, I think that there was an inclination to, if you are a Negroni drinker, you perhaps reached for Campari. But after you killed your first bottle, and who knows how fast it happened, you might have wanted to try a Negroni that was prepackaged and not made by Campari. And we started to see, we actually saw a dip in sales in March and the beginning of April, and then a return, and then big increases thereafter going into May, for not just the ready-to-drink cocktails that we produce, but also our spirits, as I think folks did start to get a little bit more experimentative at home in making perhaps their favorite cocktail. Now, all of that said, the other advantage that we've had is that we didn't launch ready-to-drink cocktails the week before the pandemic or in the middle of the pandemic. We started making bottled Negronis, and it was difficult in 2018 because there weren't a lot of ready-to-drink cocktails in the market that were made by smaller producers such as St. Agrestis. So when we began, it came with its challenges as folks didn't necessarily expect quality in a ready-to-drink cocktail. They anticipated oversweetening, and out of balance, which was surprising to us. But I guess in hindsight, I understand why. It just wasn't really something that folks had experienced in the past. But a lot of people said, "Oh, I bet your Negroni is probably too sweet for me." I said, "Well, why do you think that? Like, let's give it a try." We worked really hard to make a balanced Negroni, and anyone who's ever batched a cocktail knows that you can actually be way more precise in your batching and your proportions when you're working with larger sizes. A jigger,
cosine.
Right, Souther? I mean, it's almost an unfair advantage if you find perfect balance. I can repeat it every single time because it's on such a large scale, and we have really precise scales, literal scales, that tell us when we're at the exact right proportion of each ingredient, and that all works. But we had a lot of growing pains in the beginning by making folks have to overcome this preconceived notion of ready-to-drink cocktails. All of that work sort of paid off by the time the pandemic hit because, it wasn't like they had never heard of St. Agrestis Negronis. If they're a Negroni drinker or they started to drink Negronis previous to the pandemic and they lived in places where we had relatively strong distribution, there's a good chance that they at least noticed or have had one of our Negronis in the past. And for that reason, I believe a lot of folks did gravitate towards our Negronis and our spritz, which was on the market for a whole year before the pandemic began as well, as an option that was tried and true, already tested, and something that they knew that they would enjoy. Maybe not quite to the degree that if they were sitting at a bar like Amore Amargo, but pretty damn close to that experience of having a craft-made cocktail produced by somebody other than them, or I guess, mixed up by someone who wasn't mixing it into a pint glass.
Right. Yeah, I think that's what people were really missing was having something made for them. And I think that, given that you were already somewhat established, that probably at least gave you a leg up here. I don't know, does that work anywhere else further away from home where you're kind of, hometown advantage?
Yeah, I mean, there's some markets that we have had some success in for years at this point. We quickly got into California, and California remained a strong market for us through the pandemic, the Massachusetts, greater Boston area as well. New Jersey, a lot of folks left New York, and we always talk about you know, the folks who left New York, whether it be temporary or not, they all went to the Hamptons, but so many folks ended up going to the Hudson Valley and to New Jersey and those markets, I guess, which are still quote unquote our backyard, ended up becoming pretty good markets for us as well. And then the biggest surprise is that the second best city in the United States for St. Agrestis, and perhaps it won't surprise either of you gentlemen, but it's Minnesota, or Minneapolis is the city. I mean, the market there is so good for us. We do more business in Minneapolis than we do in Los Angeles or San Francisco. And it's partially because we have an absolutely incredible distributor, but also because there's such an incredible appetite for food and drink, and there is sort of an already developed palate for herbal and bitter, in part for a long, long time, thanks to the Scandinavian culture that has always been there.
Yeah, absolutely. That surprises me not at all. I have a lot of familiarity and a lot of love for the Twin Cities. They punch way above their weight in terms of what a high class, high grade, and how educated the consumers are in food and beverage there. A lot of amazing aquavit, a lot of amazing, like you said, interesting herbal Scandinavian liqueurs. I mean, Jesus, Malort. I know that's Chicago, but like that's in that same vein of what you're talking about there.
Totally.
And, yeah, I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to say is Minneapolis is cooler than you think, and you should probably go visit it.
Yeah, I kind of agree. There's some other cool things going on in Minneapolis that I don't think people have heard enough about yet. In the sort of bitter world. Listen, I want to touch on, before we end up wrapping up this episode, that you and your brother have another company that has nothing to do with booze, but it's in the consumable realm, and you guys make and sell vegan deli meats.
We do. Which, yeah,
I'm super intrigued by. You know, my partner is vegan. You know, we offer food now at Amore Margo. Since the pandemic, we were required to offer food. So all the food we offer is vegan. I'm the chef of the situation. So I'm in there making all this vegan food. And I have to say, in fairness, I'm a pretty skeptical of all of the fake, I don't know what you call them, but, you know, fake imitation meats. I try and just sort of like cook vegetables. Like, I don't know that that's in my world, but I will also say I've given them very little chance. So I'd love to talk a little bit, at least, about your vegan deli meats and why did this happen?
The why is a simple answer that you guys will obviously understand immediately. 70% of our customers, by number of customers, not by revenue, but 70% of our customers were bars, restaurants, and that went away overnight in March of 2020. We looked at each other and thought, my brother's been involved with St. Agrestis. He was actually the guy who planted the flag in California for the brand. When I convinced him to come on board, we immediately shipped him out that way. But when the pandemic began, he came back here, and we were scared shitless. We thought that the brand would perhaps not survive the turbulent times that we were about to dive into. So the trend felt right with a lot of people pivoting towards plant-based alternatives. I didn't see anyone doing cold cuts really well in the alternative meat category or the plant-based meat category. Now for years, and this was sort of inspired by a trip to Mexico years ago, I started to eat seitan, which is vital wheat gluten, usually chickpea flour, and water cooked in some sort of a broth. And I started to experience vegan tacos made from seitan, let's call it 5 years ago in Mexico City. And I thought, wow, when I come back to the US, I'm going to start cooking a lot of seitan because it seems to have this really incredible texture to it. It has a lot of it's gluten because it's wheat, so not everyone can consume it, but I don't have an intolerance to gluten. So I started cooking it, and one day I just decided I was going to start kind of making some cold cuts because I'm Italian American. I grew up in New Jersey. I missed an Italian sub, and there was nothing on the market that I could get to kind of, you know, get that craving fixed. So I created ham and pepperoni after a bunch of different iterations of it using spices, and a lot of which I have great, incredible access to because of what I do for a living, buying herbs and spices and turning them into Amaro. And I jokingly was calling it Louis Luncheonette, as like, hey, friends would come over, we'd meet in the park, and I'd bring a bag or a basket of Italian subs made with Louis fake cold cuts, fake meat cold cuts or plant-based cold cuts. I'd say, hey, here's a Louis Luncheonette sandwich, almost as a joke. And I kind of brought the idea to my brother Matt and my business partner Steven, and we were like, yeah, well, we're not going to have much to do right now. We can't go see accounts. All we can do is make spirits and cocktails here, and you know, that's only a portion of the job. A big portion of my time was spent running around with a bag full of booze, and that obviously was immediately not a possibility. So that's the why and the kind of how it came about. And we started making the idea happened in by March. We were already, you know, okay, let's move forward with it. The business didn't fully get off the ground until fall of last year, which makes sense considering it's a totally new world for us, the food items, and we don't produce the food here in the same facility. We have a share of a commercial kitchen that's where we cook. And
I mean, that still seems like a pretty fast takeoff, March to the fall.
Like, we move pretty quickly around here in all things. Like the day we decided we were going to launch a bag in box Negroni, like 3 weeks later, we were launching a bag in box Negroni. Like it's the beauty of not having a higher power to answer to and being an independent distillery. And just a bunch of people who are like, you know, willing to put in the work for 12, 14 hours a day. We were lucky enough that we were able to work through.
I think it's a very leap and the net will appear situation.
Yes. Yes. And then the business was, you know, tricky and in launching a plant-based deli meat within an industry that we had no idea about. But the fun part is, and this is kind of like a recent addition, we launched a plant-based rib. We're calling it Pig Savin Rib.
I checked out the website. I saw all this stuff.
Yeah, thanks, Souther. I appreciate you checking it out. The Pig's Haven rib kind of changed the business for us, though, because I did think that there was an appetite for something grillable that wasn't a burger or a sausage or a hot dog. And I worked really hard with my brother to create a rib experience that was made entirely from plants that really would, you know, kind of be approved even by the meat eater. And we tested it on meat eaters. That's how we decided we were going to go about it, as opposed to testing it on vegans or vegetarians. We wanted the meat eater to approve. And once we got that stamp of approval, we launched that to the market too.
Well, I think by and large, and this is just certainly one man's opinion, I think by and large, you're not really selling these things to the vegan. I think the vegan doesn't want fake meat. They didn't want meat in the first place. I think you're selling these things to the meat eater who wants to reduce his intake of meat, maybe. And I find no fault with that whatsoever. So I think that's the more clever plan. Don't test it on the vegans. I don't think they want it in the first place. Test it on the ones who are maybe trying to become a vegan, maybe. And you know, this is a weaning.
Or not necessarily trying to become a vegan, but just, I mean, this is actually why I turned around, and because I used to be a big hater on the Impossible Burger, because I was like, I don't know who this is for. It's not for vegans. It's not for me, because if I want to, you know, eat a veggie burger, I'd rather have like a super dope falafel burger or like a really awesome black bean burger than like vegetables pretending to be meats.
Right.
But then when I saw it starting to show up in Burger King and Dunkin' Donuts, I realized that like, oh, there is
what are you a doing in Burger scalable King and Dunkin' Donuts? That's what I want to know.
I don't go in. It's on the outside of it. Although to be fair, Burger King is the silverback gorilla of road trip fast food, and anybody who says otherwise doesn't know what they're talking about.
Heretics.
That's neither here nor there. The point is, it's a good way for people to think about who might not ordinarily question their meat intake to suddenly introduce a variable in there and say, huh, you know what? Do I want to not eat a cow-based burger today? And then all of a sudden you've got them thinking about their meat intake. You've got them thinking about the effects of that on the planet. You've got them, you know, questioning this default assumption that a hamburger comes from a cow. I don't know, maybe I am putting a little bit too much faith in the average American consumer, but I think that the important thing about, you know, meat substitutes, like, you know, the something like a pig saving rib. It's just the fact that that exists gets someone who might not have even conceived of that idea to think about the way that they eat meat. And I think that's really important.
Sure. I want to ask another question regarding this, though, Louis. Do you have a culinary background? How did you just, you know what, I'm just going to fucking go in the kitchen and make a thing that's never been made before?
I don't technically. I never worked in a kitchen. I mean, I made pizzas growing up and stuff like that, working in pizzerias. But I never worked professionally in a kitchen. I grew up in a household that cooked every single meal, though. You know, Dad being from Italy, there was sort of an expectation that the food was going to be fresh cooked and on the table every night by 5:30. And, you know, as traditional and you know, not the case as that should be or might be moving forward, it was an incredible way to grow up, because I grew up kind of in a kitchen every night. Come home from school, my mom, who's also of Italian descent, my nonnina, would be cooking food, and I got to spend a lot of time just kind of cooking, growing up cooking and learning that way. I think that when I started to really think about food was actually when I started to really think about the experience of enjoying things like wine and cocktails and spirits, and not just drink them, but drink them to truly experience them, is when I started to really pay more attention to flavors and food. And I believe that my experience in making balanced spirits and cocktails played a huge part in growing a culinary interest, but also honing some skills in the kitchen. And to me, cooking is therapy. Souther, I feel like you feel the same way about that, and maybe perhaps more at home than when you're cooking at a Moria Margaux, but cooking's therapy.
It's all about the process.
Yeah, exactly. And the creation of what, you know, I developed for the Louis plant-based meat, that ended up being entirely a therapeutic part of my existence. It was after a stressful week of trying to make sure that St. Agresta Samaro was in enough bars that we could pay the bills and all that in the early days. But that was that was kind of the impetus of it. So there were really good creative vibes that went into the creation of the product, because it was my therapy, and it was invented in a kitchen at my house, not, you know, in my apartment in Brooklyn. It was, that's how it was created.
Well, I'll tell you this, as a guy who admitted earlier that I haven't really tried these things before, I've never had an Impossible Burger or sausage or any of that nonsense. I'm more intrigued. And similarly, I think to the people who you said you encountered when you were doing tastings in liquor stores, I'm more intrigued to give this product a try because I know you made it yourself.
Well, I think that's a key distinction, and there's a lot of quote unquote lab developed or lab created things. And this mm-hmm. just isn't, it isn't it. We make all of our product fresh weekly. Everything's happening right now. My brother's in a kitchen cooking. It's if you ordered today, you would get your order fresh from what he's cooking today. So there's definitely, we try to communicate that, but there's an element of, oh, it's probably from some big venture capitalist lab, you know, it's not that. So I think that there's a chance that ends up making it a lot more approachable to folks too.
Yeah, I think that's true. Man, thanks for sharing that information. I know it's kind of off topic for us, but you know, I like to get off topic from time to time. What's coming up next for you? You got any new products you're going to roll off from St. Agrestis? I'm reading here in my notes here something about a podcast. You're going to try and crack into this world?
Yeah, I think that part of owning and talking about a brand is usually through the lens of whoever's asking the questions, which in this format has been super enjoyable. But in a lot of other formats, it's been a little bit less enjoyable. And when a story gets published, in so many cases, it's like, well, that's not even true. Or there's some inaccuracies. And we've had a fair bit of press. I kind of want to tell the St. Agresta story from my perspective. And I also think that there's an element of everything looks super, it looks perfect. But the reality of it is that a lot went into it, and it's not always as easy as it appears on Instagram. But yeah, that's why the podcast will be coming, and it'll be coming in the next few weeks.
Awesome. Well, man, that's great. We'll make sure we get that out there. Speaking of getting it out there, how can our listeners follow along with what all you're doing? You got an Instagram handle or other social media you want to talk about?
Yeah, Instagram's best on the social media front, just at @ST_Agrestis, but also just going to stagrestis.com and subscribing to the newsletter is also an incredible way to keep in touch if we're launching anything new or the link to the podcast when it comes out. All of that is, those are definitely the top two ways to keep in touch with what we have going on here in Greenpoint.
Awesome. You got one for the Louis Luncheonette?
Yeah, we do. That would be louisplantbase.com. And I think it's worth noting that I fought the naming of it after me. I wanted it to not be called Louis because I feel like it seems so narcissistic, but it,
you had already established it with your Louis Luncheonette baskets full of sandwiches.
and I lost that vote against my brother and my business partner. So here it is, Louis. And here I am plugging a brand when a website that bears my name as well, which feels disingenuous, but it is what it is.
I think it's the epitome of genuine though.
It is you. You're made it. You can't run from the brand.
That's true. It is me. It is me. I must be proud.
Yeah, you should be. Well, man, thank you so much for giving some of your time to us today. Look forward to maybe a day when we can stand across the bar and see each other in person again and have a drink of delicious St. Agrestis or maybe a Negroni from a box. I haven't tried the box one yet. I have tried those spritzes. They're quite good. Yeah, man. And I think I'm going to place an order for Louis. I just want to try it out. I want to try out the ribs.
I'll drop it by. You don't have to place the order, Souther. Just email me your new address. I'll get it to you.
Oh, rad. Will do after the show. Well, thanks so much for joining us for this week's episode of the Speakeasy. Tune into Heritage Radio Network for many more shows just like this one. Go to the website, heritageradionetwork.org. Up in the right-hand corner of your screen, you'll see a beating heart. Click on that so you can donate to keep shows like this one and many others on the air. So thanks so much for joining us, everybody. Cheers.
Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the air.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.